Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Richard Osborne and the Expert Language Trainer Podcast. Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 16 of the Expert Language Trainer Podcast. In this episode, I want to talk about something I mentioned in the last episode that I didn't want to take another 30 minutes so that I could actually split it up a little bit talking about it, and also because it's not 100% relevant, was Stephen Krashen's theories. Stephen Krashen is a linguist and professor at a university in America who, back in the 80s, came out with a bunch of theories, five principal theories about language learning, about language input and what makes comprehensible input that's easy, you know, that makes language learning facilitated for the learner. So it's something that I was very interested in when I was an aspiring trainer. When I was looking into doing the Delta qualification, I read a lot of Krashen stuff, and it was one of the things that I read that particularly stuck with me. I didn't mention him in my five books to read episode because actually what I had at that time was just a little PDF document that I printed out of, I don't know, maybe 10 pages or something like that, that really was like one of his early summaries, or somebody's early summary, maybe not like written by Krashen himself, but somebody had summarized his five key hypotheses into this really nice little document that I actually carried with me for a while, because I would pull it out and read it very often and remind myself. And I would go into a class and I would try to, while teaching English, try to imagine, to sort of feel out the hypotheses in practice, to try to understand the practical implications, or even just, you know, increasing my sensitivity as a teacher to the language acquisition process through understanding each one of these hypotheses. What does it mean for me as a teacher? What can I actually do to apply this to my teaching? And I probably don't consciously apply many of his theories, maybe one or two, but it's something that has profoundly marked me as a language trainer. So I'm hoping sharing them with you today, and I'm going to try very hard to find the PDF that I used to carry around so that I can put it in a link under the podcast, and you can take that with you, print it out, and, you know, take it to your next class and read it before you go in, and see what you get out of it. I'm going to go through each one of the theories and give you my take on it, what I understood from it and what I experienced from it, and just see where we get from there. So the first one, and I guess one of the most important, and also maybe arguably one of the more common sense ones, is the input hypothesis. So Krashen said that for language learning and language acquisition to be as effective as possible, the level of language that the learner is being exposed to should be at a level of what he calls comprehensible input. And he had his a basic way of describing that, which was, take whatever the current level of that learner's understanding of the language is, their ability in the language, and add one point level to it. Whatever your level system is, add one level to it, and that's the level at which you should be exposing them to language. And it makes sense, because for me anyway, when I was doing teaching, I was always taught in the CELTA to do leveled language activity. So if you've got a text and you want the learner to look at this text and give an opinion on it, some, you know, news story or something like that, then showing them at pre-intermediate level, in our European scale, a document, you know, an article from the Financial Times, is not going to, you know, that's going to freak them out. That's going to, and, you know, it's a part of one of the later hypotheses called the effective filter, that's going to get them to throw up a wall, and they're not going to be receptive to that language at all, because they're going to feel stupid, they're going to feel dumb, they're going to feel caught out by somebody who's making them foolish or feel foolish, because they don't know most of the language that's in front of them, so just feel ashamed or whatever. You know, there's a lot of negative emotions that come with feeling like you're a bit, you know, a bit of a loser when you're looking at something you totally don't understand. That the teacher's kind of telling you should understand, you feel even more like a loser, right? So input hypothesis is, always make sure that whatever you're showing them, even if the language in the thing you're showing, this is my take on it, even if you're showing them a YouTube video, okay, yes, it's above their language level, but what are they being exposed to? What are you exposing them to? The activity that you offer them is where the exposure comes from. So if your activity on a native speaking English YouTube video at a pre-intermediate level, or Financial Times article at a pre-intermediate level, is simply extracts X, Y, and Z sentence from this article that are at your level or just above, one step above your level, and that's going to be the learning activity, you know, that is fine for me as my take on the input hypothesis. If you can direct the learner's attention away from the language that would make them feel ashamed or embarrassed for not knowing, if it's clear to them that they're not expected to understand all of the words, just the ones that you've specifically targeted or that you're telling them, that you're trying to use with them in the activities, then that for me is good input hypothesis work. That your job as a teacher, they're one of the reasons why you're actually there and they're not just learning language in a bar or a polyglot club for free, is that you're helping them to get exposed to the kind of language that's not going to embarrass them. They're not going to get paired up at pre-intermediate level with someone who's advanced, because the advanced person is going to get frustrated with the lack of input from the pre-intermediate person, who will be in turn embarrassed that they can't communicate and, you know, exchange on the topics being proposed by the person at advanced level. So it works at all sorts of different contexts, and for me is common sense. But if you remember that theory, and that every activity you're doing, you ask yourself, is this just one step above the level that my learner already knows, or is this far too complicated? Is this the, you know, modal conditional when they're only at elementary level? Do they need this? Will they even understand it? Probably not. You know, this is probably not one step above their level, right? So that's the input hypothesis. The next one is the acquisition learning hypothesis. So the acquisition learning hypothesis is to make a clear distinction between learning and acquisition. Krashen's hypothesis, but also something that is, again, for me, common sense, is that language learning at the end of the day is a subconscious process, that we as human beings biologically are built to learn languages subconsciously, because in a tribal situation, your need to survive is an inbuilt biological thing. So your need to communicate is part of that, to be able to survive in a new tribe, or, you know, exchanging with another tribe or somebody who's at war with you or whatever. You know, that's important. That's a life, that level of importance, that level of need in that need pyramid of staying alive. So for me, language learning is linked to that. So it is inherently in a subconscious process. Now, as adults who have gone through the school system that told us, hey, we have a GCSE, we have an SAT, we have a baccalaureate exam where we need to give you a total amount of points after an exam that you've done in English or in French or whatever. So we're going to have to test your knowledge. And so with that end game in mind, that we're going to test your knowledge of English, vocabulary, grammar, whatever, ability to read a text and to extract the right words and translate them, etc., knowledge. We're going to, of course, go, you know, backtrack from that end of game, end objective, and we're going to make the course about giving you the knowledge that we're going to test you about at the end of the year. That makes sense. But then that means that we've gone through school thinking that languages are a technical, knowledge-based thing, that it's not a skill like learning the violin. So there is, of course, then a totality of knowledge. There's that sense of there must be a whole, there must be 100% that can be achieved. There must be a limit to the knowledge, and you can achieve that limit and get, you know, the top grade in the exam. So we grow up with this sense of languages are learned consciously. We have to see the word, remember the word, drill the word, revise the word, you know, attach the word on a post-it note to our fridge and just revise it every day before the exam comes up. And obviously, you know, common sense could kick in there and say, well, no, that's obviously not how languages are learned. No kid in the world learns a language, their first language, their second language. My kids speak three languages. My little girl who's four speaks three languages. She didn't learn that because I taught her the vocabulary and tested her knowledge and she drilled the words. She learned that because she acquired it. And so acquisition is when your subconscious brain sucks in a new bit of language, integrates it into your perceptive system of the world, so that when you touch a cup, your brain automatically pumps out the word cup, as well as what should be in the cup and the feeling and the weight, and it's a ceramic cup, so it's going to be heavier, I better be careful when I pick it up, or it's a glass cup, so I better be very careful not to break it or whatever. You know, all of these systems, languages in there as well. So when you touch a cup, you think cup, this is a cup. And in French, you think it's a, you know, une tasse or whatever. These are things that just come up automatically. You don't have to translate them in your head. The objective with language acquisition, which is not the same as language learning, language acquisition means that now when you're having a conversation in French or in Dutch or whatever, the words come without effort. That is what everybody knows, at the point where you can just effortlessly make a sentence. Maybe not like talking about politics, but you can effortlessly ask for a table in a restaurant. That's because you've acquired that language. It has become part of your subconscious way of perceiving the world. You don't need to think and translate from one language, from your first language. That is absolutely not the objective. Now, because we think it's a knowledge-based thing, we're approaching it from a learning perspective. And learning, in the dichotomy there, is when you consciously know something. So you've seen the word, you understand it, someone's explained it to you, you could explain it back to them, so you've understood it consciously as a piece of knowledge. But maybe you heard the word cup and they've explained what it is in your language, but when you touch a cup next time, that doesn't come because it's not part of your subconscious system. It has not been acquired yet. It has simply been learned. And things that have been learned, the brain is going to decide, do I keep this or not? And that's the process we're going through when we're forgetting things. Is the brain deciding, all right, I learned something today, I'm going to go away and dream. This is my take on it. I'm going to go away and dream tonight. And during that process, I'm going to start organizing all the things I learned today. And am I going to keep these words or not? That's, for me, why when I was learning French, I suddenly started having dreams in French. When I really had an overload of French in one day, I would start dreaming in French, and all the kind of bits and pieces of words randomly would come up, not necessarily from that day, but from recent times. And for me, that was the brain saying, my brain, and maybe I'm just talking complete nonsense here, but this is my take on it. It was my brain saying, I'm going to keep these words, these are really useful, and I'm going to put them into context, attach them to these ways of perceiving the world, and that triggers then my brain in the dreams is going to dream up, I've learned the word helicopter, and suddenly in my dream I'm flying in a helicopter, because my brain has attached it to the actual perception of what a helicopter is, and that's great. And then you wake up, and then the next day you know how to say helicopter in French, and hopefully that shouldn't disappear anytime soon. Talking about the forgetting curve is a good one, right, in terms of the distinction between learning and acquisition. So the forgetting curve is Ebbinghaus, I think, made it, who coined it, the forgetting curve, or the learning curve, forgetting curve, whatever it is. It was that if you learn something by a rote method, that is to say, you learn it by memorizing. So he, his experiments and subsequent experiments were done based on invented words. The scientists who were doing the tests on memory would invent a list of 50 words, get the participants to memorize them. They were totally invented, not related to any language, with no definition, just words, and you would just have to memorize the sound in your head of what you think the word sounds like, and then they would be tested on them. And it showed consistently, very consistently, that there was, and you can see the curves, it's amazing online, just look it up, Ebbinghaus curve. This like very standardized way of, if you teach the new imaginary word once and they don't practice it, it will be lost within X number of hours. If they practice it within those hours, at the end of that hour period you practice it, for example, then it's going to be remembered for a day, and then it will pass the point of being able to be recalled, and you will forget it in theory. If you revise again, maybe it can come back, but it keeps dipping down into the forgotten part of your brain, where your brain has just said, this is not, it's information I learned today, fine, I retained it for a while, now it's gone. It's like trying to remember your credit card number. You put it in and you don't remember it straight away. You put it in a few times and your brain says, all right, I've memorized this now, and I've got the physical bit of putting the number in, and we actually remember more about the physical action of putting numbers in than the actual numbers themselves. If you've ever tried to remember consciously what your PIN is and then forgotten it and then gone over to the PIN machine and done with your fingers, the shape that you think the pin code is in, and you're like, aha, now I remember what it is. You know, that should tell you a bit about that. Anyway, anecdotes. Moving on. So that should show you a little bit about what the difference between learning and acquisition is. When I tell you the anecdote, which I tell people all the time, about 10 years ago when I was in a summer camp and I had a big group of Chinese kids, and I was their instructor, their English trainer, but also their guide around London, for example. And as their guide, none of them spoke any English, or very little. And so I had to learn basic Chinese to be able to get them to stop, for example, running out in front of parked cars. And so there was one phrase which was "come here," which I still remember in my head. I don't know if it's right, but it's "go lai." I remember something like "go lai." It was "come here." I'm probably not pronouncing it right at all. Maybe I've mixed it up, but I never practiced that. I have never since had to tell a Chinese kid to come here, or any Chinese person, kids included, to come here. But that sticks in my head, and I bring up that anecdote maybe once every year or every couple of years. But you know, it's not enough. It doesn't fit into the Ebbinghaus model. That was something that was acquired because it was absolutely necessary to avoid the death of kids, therefore my firing and probably, you know, manslaughter charges in prison or whatever. So there was a very, very strong drive in my brain to memorize that phrase. And so my brain decided, yep, I'm going to acquire that. It was learned today, and I'm definitely acquiring that because that was pretty useful. And it's stuck in my brain ever since. And the same with, I know one expression in Russian, a bad word that I'm not going to repeat, in case there's anyone listening who speaks Russian. Italian, loads of bad words. Again, I'm not going to repeat. And, you know, I remembered those because you had to stay on top of the kids from not making fun of you in class. That they were using bad words, thinking, oh, he doesn't understand my language, nobody else does in the class, we're the only Italians. So I had to learn them so I could call them out on all the different languages they were speaking. So that's, for me, that's acquisition. I acquired those things. I learned them on that day. They were very quickly acquired because of the necessity of those things, because of the importance in my brain attached to those things in terms of like survival, life needs, etc., right? So learning acquisition, what does that mean for a teacher? What did that mean for me? It was, I need to really try to up my game on what I'm delivering with the words that I'm trying to teach. Because if I'm just teaching via rote learning, these learners are going to have to do a hell of a lot of work to stay within the Ebbinghaus curve. A lot of revision, which is fine, but impractical for the number of words you need to learn to become conversational, the few thousand words you need to become conversational. It's impractical to think that you're going to practice those few thousand words regularly in a rote way. It's much more practical if you can engineer some sort of scenario, some sort of role play game, for example, TPRS, doing a story like I saw today, it was really interesting. That potential has the potential to push the learning towards acquisition. So you're not just doing learning, you're also tapping into acquisition, long-term language learning, long-term benefits. So that's the language acquisition, the learning acquisition hypothesis, right? Moving on to the monitor hypothesis. The monitor hypothesis is the theory that while you are learning, you do not need to have explicit grammar instruction or explicit correction. This is something that may be a bit more contentious because obviously a lot of your learners are going to argue, I absolutely need to be corrected. If I'm not corrected, I don't learn. I'm going to end up speaking bad English, bad French, whatever. And yeah, I need to learn grammar. I know I do because I did it in school. That's really, really important. Okay. Krashen's theory is that there is a system within the brain called the monitor that is constantly checking while you're speaking language, not necessarily your native language, but a foreign language where you're conscious that you could be making mistakes and there's a performance anxiety. There's a monitor that's constantly checking, okay, I said something, what did the other person say in return? Did they echo back to me what was said in the same way? So I said, I not go to the cinema yesterday. And then the other person said, oh, you didn't go to the cinema. And that's a typical teacher thing we do. You might not be aware that that's actually helping the learner's subconscious brain categorize that as, I see, I actually made a mistake there. I'm going to try to correct that for next time. That's not something you're doing consciously, says Krashen. That's something you're doing subconsciously with this monitor that's ticking in your brain all the time when you're getting input. So I don't know, in my experience, I learned French on the streets, yo, as in I learned it from my friends and from my colleagues. I didn't actually take classes. and I've been here for 10 years, and I know I made a load of, like the other day somebody told me, hey, by the way, I was listening to you giving a presentation, and you keep saying the word for people, which in French is des gens, so people, like gens, and you're saying two people, you're saying de gens, which is obviously like direct translation from English, but in French we can't say two people, it's like the more like the original in English, where you would say two persons, so you would say deux personnes, you wouldn't say deux gens. Gens is just for the collective noun of some people, right? And I've been saying that probably for the whole 10 years I've been here, right? Now, does it matter? Not really. Why? Because the people who hear it understand it, it doesn't bother them that much, it doesn't put them off speaking to me, it didn't necessarily hurt my professionalism, so, you know, no big deal. But he said that to me, and my monitor, it's true, kicked in, and I said, you know, I said to myself, I need to remember that. Now, the next time I was saying something, I did the same mistake, and he kind of clicked his fingers and went, and I was like, oh, yeah, you did tell me it's de gens, it's not des gens. And, you know, that after that, you could say the monitor was really active. Okay, I said I didn't really agree with it, but actually I'm giving an example where I fully agree with it. My monitor was fully active because every time that word Jean came up, I was stopping myself. And even once I said it right, I actually said, des gens, and then I said deux personnes. And I looked at the guy because my monitor, I guess, was telling me, oh, you think you did it right? And look at the guy and he'll tell you. And he, you know, I looked at him and he was like, oh, what are you looking at me for? I'm like, dude, I just said deux personnes. He was like, oh, yeah, whatever. Yeah, sure, okay, great, good for you. Clap, clap, clap. You know, round of applause for the guy who's lived in France for 10 years and doesn't know how to say two people. Anyway, for me, okay, that is actually the monitor. I'm not sure to what extent it was ever ticking in the past for me. I'm not sure to what extent it was automatically ticking, and that was an explicit correction. So maybe that's where my disagreement lies. I think explicit corrections have an impact. Me, myself as a teacher, maybe somebody who's a Crashanite is going to tell me, actually, it wasn't really, you know, the monitor hypothesis is not just about it being implicit correction. You can have explicit correction in there as well. It's just that you're kind of, you know, there's a system ticking over trying to find out if you're saying the right thing, trying to confirm and reassure the brain that you are actually saying stuff that's comprehensible, that you've got a good response from the other person, that what you say seems to have been successful. So actually, most of the time, I am successful in French, despite my errors. So, you know, I think it's a really interesting thing to think about when you're thinking about how should I be correcting. So I think you should be quite reflective on how you correct your learners, right? The next hypothesis, and I'm looking at the list here and thinking actually there's six, and I said at the beginning there was five. Dope. I'm not sure if all six were in the first ever hypotheses, but this one has got six. So moving on quickly to the natural order hypothesis. This is easy and disputed and debated, but I happen to be a reasonably strong believer in this. The natural order hypothesis by Crashen is that grammar, as something that is subconsciously acquired in Crashen hypotheses, is something that is acquired in a predictable order. So the first thing you will acquire is, and this was interesting for me having kids, and I'll tell you why I'm a reasonably strong believer. The theory was the first thing a learner will learn is the present, then they will learn the past irregular, then they will learn the past regular, and the evidence, and so, you know, so on and so forth, and with, you know, adjectives and ing forms and whatever. And it was interesting because part of the theory that struck me was that, you know, Crashen would say, or somebody said when looking at Crashen series, consider how kids, when they're learning English and they're just developing it, and this happened to my 3-year-old daughter, that the first thing they do is they'll start just speaking in the present all the time. When they start speaking in the past, their gut reaction will be to use, first of all, the thing that will master before anything else is the irregular verbs, because the irregular verbs in English are kind of like new words, so it's easier for their developing brain to acquire new words than it is to acquire manipulations of words. Of you know, in English, the attaching an ending to a word is a more complex thing that comes a little bit later. And the evidence for that, which was really interesting because I saw it in my daughter, was they'll learn irregular verbs, and the first thing they'll do is when they start learning more about speaking about the past, they will attach ed to the irregular verbs. And that is absolutely true, not just to my daughter, in another person's daughter who's 6 or 7 now, I heard the same thing where, you know, my daughter will say to me, she started saying, "Daddy, I ate today in the creche or in the school," because she's in kindergarten, "I ate whatever, broccoli." And now, at the moment, because she started to use the ED form with regular verbs, so she will say, "I walked," or something like that. Now she started saying, "Daddy, I eated today. I eated some broccoli." And it's so funny and so cute. But for me, genuine supportive evidence of this theory. And like I said, another kid who's 6, who's growing up in France and growing up bilingual, also still has some of those ED endings on irregular verbs. I don't know if that's because of the mix-up of the, you know, two languages or whatever. But that's very, very interesting for me. So natural order hypothesis, I'm not going to get into it too much because I don't know the actual order. I'm just, you know, doing the 2 or 3 things that I remember. But look it up. How does that inform your teaching? Look at your curriculum. Look at your syllabus. Look at your course program. Are you actually teaching the grammar in the order that the brain naturally develops that grammar subconsciously? So if you're trying to force explicit grammar down someone's throat, are you doing it in a way that is actually against the flow of the brain? And so they might say they understand it, but the brain will kind of ignore it and won't acquire that grammar that you're trying to teach, whether grammar can be taught explicitly or not. Another argument. So next one is the effective filter hypothesis. So simple, reasonably simple, and this is the last one to go through. The effective filter hypothesis, I touched on earlier and I touched on in a previous episode. Again, common sense, but it's good to put a name to it and actually study it in your next classes, to go into the classes and think about, you know, oh, was that the effective filter that just went up there? Is learners have a filter that can be shot up when they feel too much under pressure, or there's something is stressing them out, they're under too many negative emotions, that they kind of switch off their acquisition engine. You can feel it, I think, and that's why I think it's true. When you've got somebody in the zone and they're really enjoying it and they feel comfortable, and we talked about that a lot in TPRS, about making learners feel comfortable. There were coaching sessions where we talked about making learners feel comfortable, and I think that is really important. Making a learner feel safe, making a learner feel like, you know, to get over self-esteem and problems and stuff like that. But the Crashen would say that's part of the effective filter system, where we're keeping them open to acquisition, because they're comfortable and they're feeling at ease. Once you put them in a position where they feel embarrassed, they feel ashamed, they feel like they're being pushed too hard, they feel like they're out of their depth, they feel like they're too tired, for example, they've had a really bad night's sleep, it might not be you, maybe they had a really bad night's sleep, you haven't really detected that, maybe they've just had a really big problem at home and had a bust up with their boyfriend or with their girlfriend, and, you know, they've come to you with their effective filter already up, and you, I think if you go into your next classes and think about that, you might detect that effective filter just through looking and talking to your students. You know, the one who was in class yesterday yapping on about their holidays and whatever with a big smile on their face, and today they come in and they're speaking a bit in their first language and they're not really engaging and they're looking down, they're trying to be quiet and be in the corner, that person's effective filter is up. You can try to push them and bring them back in, but actually maybe you should be thinking about, how can I help this person psychologically, as opposed to like pedagogically looking at the activities and the way I involve them. Do they need a bit of a silent period because their effective filter is up? Can that actually be beneficial to them? Another thing about Crashen that's not in these theories, but it's something he talks about a lot, is the silent period. And this is again something I saw in my kids, that when kids learn language, and for me when adults learn language, it can also be applied, the silent period is when they're observing what people are doing in the language. So today I was in that Mandarin class and I was watching what the teacher and the participants were doing. I was an observer under no pressure. My effective filter was way down because I didn't even think I was going to participate. And suddenly my brain starts looking for answers, naturally looking for, what is the pattern here? What is that word? Why is that pronounced like that? Maybe the other word is pronounced the same. She just said it. I was right. Boom. You know, and you have this amazing process going on. I was really blown away by it this morning. Haven't been in that position for a long time as a beginner, not since the Delta, when I was learning Hungarian as part of the Delta. You know, and that for me was fascinating, because I'd had this 20-minute silent period and my brain had the time to start kind of being Sherlock Holmes and working out what's going on. And then suddenly I want to speak. spontaneously and without fear, I'm actually saying to myself, should I be cheeky enough as a not a participant, just to kind of stick up my hand and be like, can I, as an observer, say something? And I think I probably could have done. I guess there was still a little bit of anxiety there, but I genuinely felt excited, positive, very positive about contributing and sharing something. And that's what Krashen would call the silent period. Kids do that too. Kids start acquiring language very young, between the ages of, you know, even before the age of one. If you look at Patricia Kuhl on TED Talks, it's really interesting, her talk about kids acquiring phonetics already before the age of one. But between like one and two, very often that's the silent period. Kids start talking there, but they're not going to start saying things just because you taught them that word that day. You might have said that word already in lots of different places, lots of different times. And finally, their brain has caught the bug, has got the itch to actually repeat it, has had enough input at a comprehensible level. So comprehensible input, you know, the input hypothesis. The effective filter is down. You know, it's the right kind of grammar. It's in the right natural order, etc., etc. And you just get this incredible urge to speak. And I think that's what kids get. And they suddenly start blurting out all this stuff. And people will say, parents will say, he just all of a sudden one day just started talking. Or he like started saying things I never even knew he knew how to say. And it's right. It's the silent period. My kid, my girl went to school when she was, French school, when she was, you know, like one and a half, something like that. And she had a very long silent period in French school. And I bet you a lot of parents who are listening who are immigrants like me will know that feeling of, there was actually a very long time where my kid didn't speak. And I was wondering, is everything okay? Are they going to be okay? Are they going to survive? And of course they do, because they're fine, they're kids. And you think they're a bit slow, and then one day they just shock you, because you go in and they're talking away to their friends in the second language, and you think they had this period of observing, of being, you know, calm, cool, observing from the corner, having that time necessary to acquire without even practicing, which is amazing as well when you think about the logic behind that, acquiring without even practicing, and then starting to blurt out stuff and producing, you know, whereas we're taught you got to get them to present, practice, produce, you got to do test, teach, test, you got to get them, show them the word and get them to practice it straight away. And that, you know, that has its place, but think about the silent period and think about, is it so bad if my learner takes a little time out, sits in the corner, maybe doesn't contribute? Is that person who's silent in the group, maybe it's not my job as a teacher, as I'm taught, to make sure that everybody gets a chance to contribute? Or could they contribute something very minimal where they still are listening, they still are observing and having that silent period, but contributing something, just a yes or a no to the question? So they are still contributing to the activities and to the overall functioning of the class, but they're not having to produce the language that I'm teaching. They're not under pressure. If they want to, they can. And then maybe the next class, that thing I wanted them to produce will just pop out, right? So that for me is fascinating, that whole idea of silent period. Think about that the next time that you're doing your classes, and think about all of these things, you know, really consider all of these things the next time you go into your class and future classes. And hopefully I'll find that PDF, you can print it out, bring it with you, and really think about that the next time you're doing your classes. And when you come out of your class, what happened there, what bits of Krashen's thing do I feel like I observed? Really just consider it, and you'll find that actually over many experiences of this, you might start really not necessarily improving your teaching, but having a way better way of describing why what you're doing as a teacher works well. We're coming back to the legitimacy question from the previous episode. The more you can describe what you do and say how you're doing it well, the more you can pitch to future students who'd say, yeah, I've seen your videos, I know you're a great teacher, how do you do it? And you're like, well, I can tell you, it's not just magic, it's not just, you know, I'm not just pulling it out of my ass, it's something that I actually know from, you know, proper professor linguist in America who has these theories, and I took them into my class and I experienced them and experimented with them, and feel very, very confidently that I've understood them and I've internalized and or I've you know, I've got that way of describing things now that influences the way that I teach. So it didn't necessarily make me better, but it made me way more confident in what I was doing. It made me way more reassured, and now that feeling of legitimacy is coming from a lot of different places. So definitely check it out, and I would be really interested to hear feedback if you go into your next class and you feel like one of these things has had an impact on your thoughts about teaching. Share those thoughts with me on LinkedIn or whatever. Send me an email, send me a text, whatever you want. I'm open, and I'd love to hear from you. So thanks for listening, and take care. Thanks for checking out this podcast. And if you want to know more, please follow me on LinkedIn, on Instagram, on Facebook, on YouTube. All the links are in the description. I really look forward to seeing you in the next episode.